Good morning and welcome to Focus on Health, the weekly radio program where we talk about all the great things happening at Band East Medical Center. I am your host, Lori Foster, and on today's program, we're going to be talking about dementia with nurse practitioner Jade Williams. Before we get started into our program, I do have just a couple of announcements I'd like to share. First of all, we are very pleased to welcome Quincy Olendijk. She is a physician assistant. She is the newest health professional to join our physician provider team at Band East Medical Center. Quincy will be working with our orthopedic surgeon, Dr. Samasetti, providing orthopedic services in our surgery and specialty clinic department. I'll be sharing more information about Quincy and when she will be starting to see patients in upcoming programs. For now, we do want to extend a warm welcome again to Quincy Olendijk, who has joined our team. And secondly, we have a community event coming up on June 30th that I would like to share with listeners. Community members are invited to attend a free educational program on human trafficking in Iowa. It will be held Tuesday, June 30th from 5 to 7 p.m. in the Band East Medical Center Clinic Boardroom. There is an exterior door that attendees can enter through. It is located between the hospital and clinic entrances, and there is a sidewalk that is leading right up to that exterior door. The event is sponsored by Band East Medical Center and Trinity Lutheran Church of Ellsworth and is open to the public. The presenter will be Stacy Besh of Team Iowa, and she will be sharing information on the realities of human trafficking in Iowa, including why the state has become vulnerable to trafficking activity and what community members can do to help prevent exploitation. Some of the key topics that she will be covering will include what makes our state susceptible to human trafficking, the realities of human trafficking occurring in our state, some common misconceptions and myths surrounding trafficking, warning signs and indicators community members should recognize, and then practical action steps that individuals can take to protect vulnerable populations. Human trafficking is often misunderstood and can occur in communities of all sizes, including rural areas. This educational event aims to increase awareness, equip attendees with knowledge to recognize potential trafficking situations, and empower community members to take an active role in prevention and advocacy. Once again, I do want to share, there is no cost to attend. We certainly encourage all community members to join us. And again, that will be Tuesday, June 30th from 5 to 7 in the clinic boardroom. With that, we will go ahead and get started into our program today. The month of June is Alzheimer's Awareness Month, and it's a good time to be talking about dementia. So thrilled to have nurse practitioner Jade Williams with us today to talk about this important topic. Good morning and welcome to you, Jade.
Good morning.
Welcome back.
Yes, thank you.
So nice to have you on the show.
Thanks. Yeah, so like Lori said, today is, and really the entire month is just about dementia and, of course, what those, that's that umbrella term and kind of what fits underneath of that. So really today, I just want to discuss how can we understand dementia and what we know currently, and then as well what we're learning or what's on the horizon. So dementia affects millions of individuals and families worldwide, yet despite how common it is, many misconceptions remain. Is memory loss a normal part of aging? What causes dementia? Can anything be done to reduce the risk? And perhaps most importantly, how can families navigate that journey after a diagnosis? So I'd like to explore the latest understanding of dementia and discuss those warning signs, review healthy lifestyle habits that may support that brain health, and share resources for patients and caregivers. So whether you're concerned about your own memory or caring for a loved one or simply interested in maintaining brain health, I would hope that you can find some of this information helpful and useful. So really delving in, what is dementia? So this is just kind of a basic overview, but many people think that dementia is a disease, but in actuality, dementia is more of that umbrella term, and it describes the symptoms that affect memory, thinking, reasoning, as well as daily functioning. And so dementia is not considered a normal part of aging. While the occasional forgetfulness can occur as we get older, and, you know, this is something I think we all tend to struggle with a little bit from time to time, but dementia really goes beyond that misplaced keys or forgetting a name or potentially something on your calendar. It really begins to interfere with everyday life. And so what would be those common symptoms that we would start to be concerned about or maybe start to consider investigating a little bit further, that would be things like memory loss, affecting those daily activities on a more consistent, frequent basis, difficulty solving problems. And so a lot of times that can be things from managing a checkbook to or other things that require executive functioning, so more of that critical thinking component or piece, trouble finding words, confusion about a time or a place. So if you feel like you become disoriented, changes in your judgment, and then personality or mood changes. And so the most common form of dementia what we tend to think of as Alzheimer's disease. And this accounts for approximately 60 to 80% of dementia cases. And then other types that we typically hear about are going to be the vascular dementia, Lewy body dementia, frontotemporal lobe disorder, and then mixed dementia. Each type affects the brain differently, which is why symptoms can vary from person to person. And then other important messages for you to consider would be that dementia is not a single condition, and receiving a diagnosis is often the beginning more so, and then understanding what type is present. So to have a diagnosis can take a long time, and it shouldn't be something that's your provider or specialist is assuming to take lightly. You know, I wouldn't anticipate necessarily walking into the first appointment and walking out with a definitive diagnosis. You know, it usually takes some time and different types of ways of managing it, and possibly even referrals to other specialists so that we can really be confident in that diagnosis. So how do we decode these specifically and come up with it? So like I mentioned, getting a diagnosis can be overwhelming, and families often report feeling frightened, confused, and uncertain about the future. The diagnostic process, like I said, usually begins when a patient or family member notices these changes in memory or thinking. And sometimes it might not even be that you're noticing the changes in their memory or thinking. It's more so that you're noticing that they may be more paranoid, or they may think that something's being misplaced in their home, or somebody came in and took something, because they definitely couldn't have misplaced it or lost it. And so it's that little underlying paranoia, or they may start to kind of close off their environment. So maybe they were really outgoing and social, and now maybe they're only visiting with certain friends, or they're only going to smaller events, or they get easily overwhelmed if they're going out into large public gatherings or things like that. So those could be little key indicators along the way that maybe there's something going on cognitive-wise. So during the intake process, you know, your provider should be asking for a medical history review, completing a physical exam, may even consider cognitive testing, or ask you to come back for cognitive testing. Typically entails some type of blood work as well, and then may even consider brain imaging, typically a CT, and then can progress into wanting an MRI. So these tests will typically determine whether the symptoms may be caused by dementia or by another condition. And so really it's kind of identifying, is there an acute issue that we can treat that will help clear up the cognitive deficits that we're seeing? Or is this really truly something that's long-term and going to continue to progress? So some conditions that we tend to consider that can mimic dementia could be things as simple as a vitamin deficiency, thyroid disorders. Sometimes it could be due to polypharmacy or medication side effects. Also could be depression, you know, or even anxiety. A lot of times we... As our population or our family ages, we tend to think that it might make life easier if we eliminate some of their responsibilities. And so we have to remember that that independence allows them to continue to feel that they are having value, right? Mm-hmm. And so, yes, that they're useful. And because everybody wants to feel a value. They want to feel that they bring value to the table. So if we start taking those independencies away. Could be something as simple as cleaning their own house, doing their laundry, cooking a meal, running errands, volunteering. I mean, the things could typically be endless, but if we start thinking by taking those things away from them that we're actually improving their quality of life, it might actually increase their risk for depression as well as anxiety. Because then they start to wonder, well, what am I supposed to be doing with my time? You know, we tend to consider sometimes retirement to be like this life of luxury. But in the reality, you know, you can only go on so many vacations, financially speaking, physically speaking. You know, that's not necessarily what retirement actually looks like for most Americans. And so really thinking about, how can we maintain a quality of life and as much independence as possible with whatever those choices look like in a safe manner, so that we aren't increasing that risk for depression or anxiety or also perpetuating the cognitive deficit that we're seeing? Because right. The more we take away the independence, the executive function, then we're unfortunately only kind of helping enabling that disease process to continue. Because they don't have anything that's stimulating them, right? So, and then of course, sleep disorders. So as we get older, our sleep habits tend to change, you know, for whatever reason. And females, postmenopausal, you know, the sleep habits change. It also could be, you know, that you're no longer needing to get up for the whatever your responsibilities were for specifically work, as an example. And so all of that changes. But then also if they start to have any issues with depression or anxiety, that can also affect their sleep habits or whatever maybe they're doing recreationally. You know, if they're retired and they maybe start socializing more and then maybe they start to have more alcoholic beverages or something of that nature, that we know is also disruptive to sleep as well. And so all of those things then unfortunately don't allow the brain time to rest and kind of repair itself like it needs to by nature. And so then unfortunately that can also be mimicked as a concern for the development of dementia or can also make the disease progress as well. So this is why it's so important to have a thorough evaluation, but also visit with somebody who has a clear understanding of kind of these disease processes so that you're not loosely being labeled with a diagnosis without a real investigation into what's going on. And so really, I want to just take a minute to review briefly the major dementia diagnoses that I've mentioned, specifically Alzheimer's disease. So like I said, this is one of the most common types, and it typically begins with memory problems and gradually progresses to difficulties with language, reasoning, and daily activities. Just a quick caveat, you know, I do have quite a bit of handouts that I like to provide to my patients, but one specifically, it's a nice one-page piece of paper, and it just kind of breaks this down, and then it starts outlining the typical symptoms that we see with each diagnosis, which is really nice, and I generally encourage families to take that with them and just kind of mull it over, you know, observe their family member that they're concerned about, and then just kind of see where do they feel like it starts to assimilate with. Because even when you go in, you know, it's typically a snippet in time, right? We're only seeing that patient for anywhere from 15 to 30 minutes if it's a real thorough, you know, appointment. Maybe even upwards of 45 if you're going to see a specialist. And so that's really just a very brief window in their 24-hour period. It also could be a very good day for them, or it could be a very bad day. So you have to take that as well with a grain of salt. And so that's how families and friends become so important into helping as well foster a diagnosis. So, sorry, delving back into then the other dementia diagnoses. So vascular dementia, typically we tend to have this link more towards patients who have strokes or reduced blood flow to the brain. Symptoms may appear suddenly or progress in a stepwise fashion. Lewy body dementia. So this one, I feel like it gets kind of interchanged with Parkinson's disease. So Lewy body specifically, the first symptom is typically thinking and cognition, okay? And then that one can involve visual hallucinations, fluctuations in cognition, sleep disturbances, and then Parkinson-like movements. But the typical first onset of those symptoms is going to be thinking and cognition. If we're talking a Parkinson's diagnosis, then typically we're going to see actual abnormalities within the gait of the patient. And so really understanding that Parkinson's disease and Lewy body dementia are caused by the same abnormal proteins, Lewy bodies. And so that's why I think sometimes they get interchangeably discussed. A patient has these Lewy body proteins, they start to build up in the brain, and they are closely related. But the main difference is which symptoms present first and then continue to dominate the patient. And so this is why it's so important sometimes to involve a neurologist or a specialist, because they can really help kind of get down into those weeds and figure out. And then, of course, there's always a concern you could have multiple different types of cognitive issues or cognitive diagnoses. So and then another one that's becoming more prevalent is the frontotemporal lobe dementia. So this is often affecting the behavior, judgment, and personality before memory. Sometimes this is one that we see more so diagnosed in younger adults. We also assimilate it with concerns of if they've had any type of traumatic brain injuries, you know, football players, NFL football players, this has been a big one, or hockey players. But this is typically in much younger patients. And then, you know, the research continues to make progress in understanding these conditions. And then newer diagnosis tools are helping clinicians identify diseases earlier than ever before. You know, when I really started in specializing in older adult care in my, you know, I guess you would say early 20s, I went to an Alzheimer's meeting, and there was actually a case at that time diagnosed in Fort Dodge that it was kind of like a case study that was being disseminated at that time. And it was a young woman. She was in her 40s at that time, and she had been diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's disease. She had a prominent job, I mean, a young family, you know, and so at that time, I can't imagine how difficult that was to be diagnosed with that, because so we're talking, you know, 20 years ago that this woman was diagnosed at a young age. And so it becomes limiting in and of itself when you have that. And then it's also kind of identifying, well, where are they at in the disease process and what decisions can they make safely, you know? So the sooner you have a diagnosis, I don't want patients to think it's necessarily like a death sentence, because it can be this is a chronic disorder, but there are things and availability. And once we have an understanding of what's going on, now we have good tools that can kind of help help you manage it as it does progress. So thinking about ways, how can you try to prevent the development of it, or what can you do to reduce your risk of development?
Yes, I think that's probably like the number one question.
Yes.
People all think about
right
when we are discussing the topic.
Yes, and it's so difficult, but obviously thinking about how can you build a better brain, or how can you offset. And so my number one would be sleep. That's probably the biggest non-negotiable. None of these other things are going to help you if you're not sleeping well. And so really thinking about how can you improve your sleep hygiene, preferably with non-pharmacological interventions, if possible. I would say that would be one of the last approaches to manage it. So if you can, sleep hygiene is one of the most difficult things, and it requires a lot of investment, because really to change your sleep cycle, you need a good 2 to 3 weeks that you're like focusing in hard on it. And it usually will affect your next day because you're trying to retrain yourself into these sleep hygiene practices so that you're getting better sleep at night, so that your brain's able to actually function appropriately. But there's usually a little bit of a lag there because you're not sleeping as well, right? Yes. So there's like, so, you know, and it depends on what you do for work. And so I understand how it can be very difficult. Or if you have young children, you know, things of that nature. So focusing on sleep and having a conversation with your provider, also being evaluated. So maybe you need to have a sleep study and make sure you don't have like sleep apnea or something of that nature that could be a culprit as to why you're waking up and not feeling rested, and kind of going from there. And then if, you know, you've done everything and you still don't feel like you're asleep and you're waking up refreshed, then you could take a look at, well, what would be some non-pharmacological supplements that you could take? You know, there's different things on the market, anything from, you know, melatonin, vitamin E is a great option as well. So visiting with your provider, magnesium. So visiting with your provider and figuring out what would maybe be the best fit for your current situation. And then from there, if those aren't working for you, then I think really investigating how can the pharmacological options or the prescription medications help you. Definitely, you know, I would caution, and I do caution my patients, Benadryl, we know, has been around for a very long time. You can purchase it over the, you know, over the counter, but there are significant risks to taking it on a very consistent basis. Now, if you take it for, you know, one dose here or there, or a Tylenol PM and it has, you know, Benadryl in it, or the type of, you know, antihistamine product in it to help you sleep, that's not probably going to do a ton of harm, but it compounds on itself. And also it has what we call this anticholinergic effect. So it's drying out your brain to some degree. And so then it makes it very difficult. And so studies have shown if you're repeatedly using this for more than, you know, upwards of 2 to 3 months, then it can become an issue and can cause cognitive deficits, unfortunately. So just thinking about that. And if that is something that you're using on a frequent basis, once again, having a conversation with your provider about what would be some safer options for you to consider.
Right. Very good. Great information, Jade.
Thanks.
And it just supports, I mean, I know in the past, gosh, maybe 3-4 weeks, you're the third healthcare professional that has commented on the importance of sleep. And gosh, for even more reason, I mean, and so I just love that you share that with listeners, because all of our listeners out there have heard me say, I am such a believer in good sleep. I think it is so important. It's such a critical part of our health. And so, and then even for the reasons of which you share, when we're talking about dementia,
right.
So important.
Yes, absolutely. So if you can get your sleep in order, then we can start moving into some of these other key pieces, which would be considering like activity, right? And so I probably sound like a broken record because I feel like I talk about these same points.
No, it's good.
But exercise. So here's why, and if I want to get a little nerdy or can for you. So the biggest thing about exercise is that it helps maintain your hippocampus. So this is great for your memory, okay? And it's a portion of the brain that we need to help maintain the size of. And so if you're exercising, you're increasing blood flow, and so it's going to help, right? So you increase the blood flow, and then it helps improve your insulin sensitivity, which is also great, protective for your brain. And then it also decreases inflammation. And I'm talking general inflammation, right? Through the brain, throughout your body. And so research is really suggesting that the sweet spot for this is 30 to 45 minutes most days of the week. So we've kind of moved away from saying, I mean, if you look at guidelines right now, I guess, if you pulled it up, it would still probably say 150 minutes of physical activity. But we know, but we know that you can do better. Mm-hmm. And so one of the most interesting things I just learned actually this week was, there's always been this conversation. How did we land on these 7,000 to 10,000 steps? And why is this? Well, because it's an attainable number and we're not attaching time to it. So if you physically wanted to walk 10,000 steps, you'd be committing to yourself essentially 90 minutes of activity. So that's the goal. We want you to be moving for 90 minutes at minimum a day. So if you're getting that upward step count of 10,000, you should essentially be moving for a minimum of 90 minutes a day, whether that's vacuuming your house, you know, walking, you know, to the restroom and wherever else you're moving through or whatever. But it's a visual reminder to us, but we're also not being tied down then to the clock, because it can seem so overwhelming to be like, oh my gosh, I have to find 90 minutes throughout this day to commit. Something else to consider, you can do 10 air squats every hour for 8 hours. It's just as effective and good for your body as it is to do a 30-minute walk. So if you can't get in the steps, then just go to the bathroom and do 10 air squats quickly every hour, and you're actually doing just as good for your hippocampus, your inflammation, your insulin sensitivity, and hopefully preventing not only cardiovascular disease, but helping your memory as well.
That's and a it'll, great option.
Yes. And it'll make you more alert at work, more so than if you, you know, go try to strive to give up 30 minutes over your lunch break, which then in and of itself could be creating a stressful situation to you, you know, trying to hit that 30-minute mark. But if you're getting up and moving, getting your blood pumping every hour, you're also going to be more alert while you're doing your work, and probably more efficient at what it is that you're doing.
I mean, I even think of people at home. Okay, when you go into the kitchen, maybe you're going to go get a glass of water. Do some air squats right there. Even if you need to hold on to your kitchen counter,
you can do some
air squats. So every time you're maybe going to get some more water, or you're walking to a different room in your house throughout the day, think about how
brushing
you can incorporate
teeth.
That.
My kids used to think I don't do it as much. So I'm telling you something that I'm hoping to start incorporating into my life. But I used to do this all the time. And so I'd like brush my teeth and the kids would walk in the bathroom and I'd be doing air squats, or like if you're blow drying your hair, or, you know, any of those things, because you're standing there. So you might as well multitask a little bit. Plus, that's also really good for the for your brain as well. You're doing multiple different things, engaging. And so that's great as well. So just a couple things to think about. So, you know, really we're recommending a more well-rounded exercise protocol or routine for yourself. So thinking of walking, that's that low intermittent activity for yourself. We're not really focusing on getting your heart rate up or anything. It's more so just kind of fixating, like I said, on that 7,000 to 10,000 step count for the day.
Such great information, helpful tips shared, not only for patients, but family members and loved ones and the caregivers too. I do want to mention to our listeners, Jade oversees our skilled care program here at the hospital. As she mentioned in the program too, she is an adult primary care gerontologist and she sees patients at Vandy's Family Health Clinic here in Webster City. If you have questions or you would like to schedule an appointment with Jade, you can call the clinic at 515-832-7800. Again, thanks so much, Jade. Great program.
Thanks.
That will do it for today's edition of Focus on Health, brought to you by Vandy's Medical Center, where our focus is you.